Good morning, everyone. Strange to have.
This fifth meeting, do we have a motion?
So moved.
And a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor to approve the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The minutes are approved. Item number three is public comments. If you would like to make a comment, please come forward, give your name and address, and you will have 2 minutes, please. Anyone for public comments?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Need to be here. My name is Michelle Whitbeck. Do you need the address as well, you said?
Yes.
712 Hibbins Grant Boulevard. As part of a group that is striving to organize...
Hang on just a second. Is the microphone on?
I'll move over here.
Okay.
As part of a group that's striving to organize an association for responsible short-term rental owners, I support and thank the town for enforcing its reasonable current regulations on short-term rentals. Non-enforcement would only hurt the excellent rental owners and put us in a negative position. So I'm curious to see what is on the agenda today. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else to speak? Nope. Going once, going twice. All right, that will end the public comments section. Item number four, police matters, employee years of service recognition. Chief Ritchie.
Before I start with the employee recognitions, I'm going to take a minute to recognize the mayor and his committee and thank you as police chief for your continued support throughout 2020. A lot's going on. A lot of things have happened. You guys have never wavered. You stood behind us, stood with us. You've got confidence in us, and I hope we've been able to continue policing proudly like we have been for many years. So I want to thank you all very much.
Absolutely. We thank you and your force.
All right. I'll start off with some of the years of recognition. My first one is PFC Lipari. Who's going forward for me? Stand on the side for me and we'll keep our wall. You get your mask on, you're good. All right. Bob, I have the honor of recognizing Officer Lipari for 5 years of service. As with all of our new officers, they start on patrol. And while on patrol, he's always stayed very busy, very proactive. And when whatever district he was assigned to, he took great responsibility for and care to ensure that all the needs of our citizens were met. And then he moved into a school resource officer position and just did a fantastic job there, or not just keeping our young people safe while they were in classes, and hopefully we'll get back to the in-person classes eventually, but keeping our students safe and not stopping when the bell rang for the end of the day, continue to work with these young people, continue to have activities and just engage in the police with the police officers, show them why we're here in our community and how we support our youth and make sure they have a safe environment. He's back on patrol now, doing again what he loves, working the streets, keeping our community safe. And I greatly appreciate your 5 years service and well done. Good job. Thank you. Good job. I'll call up FTO Tyler Henderson. And he is not in uniform today because he's light duty. There's some things going on, but I'll tell you about that in a minute. Again, five years of service with the town of Mount Pleasant, which it's just incredible when you think about what's going on again in the nation, where maybe folks are looking for other jobs. They're not. They're looking at long-term careers, being part of this community, part of this police department. Again, started just like any other officer, as a patrol officer, working hard and dedicating himself to the citizens. But then he knew he wanted to do more. He wanted to train the new officers, took the FTO assessment, earned the rank of field training officer, and I think it's such an important job. I promoted two others this morning and reminded them they're the ones that get these new officers, brand new into law enforcement. It's their job not only to teach them the right way and how to police properly and how to treat people properly, but also to remind them why they got into this, in police service in the first place. That's to serve our communities. And I know he does a great job of that. I know he's missing the road right now, not able to get out of work, but he, but still, could stay home, I'm sure, the doctor would let him, but he'd rather be here working with our training, training bureau, so he's in-house, helping continuing to train and educate our police officers. And I know the sergeant training office definitely appreciates that, all the work you do in there, especially as we do our pre-academy and our pre-academy before we go to the academy in Columbia. It's very key that the work he's doing and the other trainers are doing to ensure the highest quality and training officers we have. So congratulations on your 5 years, and I look forward to many, many more. Well, last but certainly not least, SRO, Tamika Brown. Wonderful. I don't know how this is possible, but I'm recognizing her for 20 years. This started very young. Now, it's just what an honor it is to recognize any employee who hits the 20-year mark. Especially we talked about law enforcement, all we have to deal with and go through. And 20 years here at the town of Mount Pleasant, with our Mount Pleasant Police Department, and you've done a great majority of it in the schools. Once some of these RSROs get in these schools, that's where they want to be. You could have been promoted many times. There's no question in my mind, the sergeant or lieutenant by now. But your love and desire for our students and their safety, their education, It just shows with all the schools that you've been involved in. I guarantee there are students that still come up to you today that have already left your classes or left with the school you're protecting and reach out to you. And I can tell you, SRO Brown, she's a person too that, even with the school being out, all of our SROs, but I know her specifically, will reach out and stay in touch with her kids, stay in touch with her school staff. That's how important it is. So it's not just a position. You would think some officers, oh, this is going to be a cake job. I'm going to go work my 7:30 to 3:30, what have you. Not our SROs, and especially not SRO Brown. She is so dedicated to our young people and to our students. It's just an incredible job. And if that's where you want to be, I hope you stay there and continue doing a great job. But when you're ready to test for promotions, I know you'll do well with that. So I just want to congratulate you on 20 incredible years. That's huge. Good job. Thank you,
Chief. Thank you. Appreciate all that y'all do for us. Item number 5, judicial matters. There are no agenda items for item number 5. Item number 6 is legal matters, which includes an update on contractual matters regarding current legal representation and negotiations with David Pagliarini as per recent council vote. B, executive session to discuss contractual matters regarding current legal representation, and let's be clear, those are two separate items, right? One is the current contract, and the other is the pending contract. Am I correct on that?
Yes, sir.
Okay. With David Pagliarini as per recent council vote. Before we get a motion to go into executive session, I see Mr. Miller sitting here. We do have some new information that is contractual that involves legal advice for which an executive session would be warranted. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Do we have a motion to go into executive session?
Mr. Mayor,
yeah.
I have a question on this. At what point do these documents become public, or are they?
You read my mind. That's my first question for executive session.
Oh, okay. Because I didn't know. Yeah. Okay.
You're scaring me with your mind reading abilities. I guess we will find that out. That's a legal question. We'll find that out in executive session about these documents becoming public.
Mayor, I also have a question.
Sure.
Item A is not under executive session.
Well, I think the update was to ask if we have an update so that we know that we're going into executive session if there was nothing new.
Gotcha. Okay.
So do we have a motion to go?
So moved.
Right. Second.
Any discussion? Before we vote, I will let the public know that after executive session, the committee may take action on any item, including any subsection of any section listed on an executive session agenda or discussed in an executive session during a properly noticed meeting. Is there any discussion on the motion to go into executive session for the purpose of contractual matters regarding current legal representation and negotiations with David Pagliarini as per recent council vote? Any discussion? All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? We are in executive session, which I understand is back here.
Yes, sir. Jerry.
Return from executive session. No action was taken. No votes were cast. I don't believe we have any motions to follow. That will move us, that will complete item 6C, which moves us to item 6D, overview of services to be performed as part of the economic impact study for the Shem Creek area as a result of the Crab Bank Renourishment Project. Thank you, Mr. DeMora, for engaging a consultant to do that for us. This was voted on by council overwhelmingly, and so we just wanted to kind of hear exactly what they would be doing for what we voted for. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. Good morning to you, members of the committee. You're correct. Per council directive, the town is now engaged Dr. Joey Von Nessen. He's a PhD economist at the University of South Carolina.
Heard that, Mr. Rambo?
Yeah.
Okay.
he's an economist with expertise in market forecasting and regional economic analysis. Yeah. So, as I mentioned, we're under contract, and the purpose of their contract is to study both the short-term and the long-term effects and different scenarios of what could happen if the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers go forward with their current plan. And what they'll be measuring specifically is to the extent of which local business activity will likely be impacted, and the secondary effects, or the sort of the multiplier or ripple effects, and then lastly, its impact on local revenues, revenues that the town gets from that activity. The methodology is sort of fascinating. Reading through how they propose to go about their work, they measure the economic impact of a business really through its procurement, whether it procures labor or resources or materials to help put a product or service on the street. And so they measure that, and they go about measuring the economic impacts, its ripple effects, and they build a model. And that model is fed by a survey instrument that they build. We take it here at the town. We've already brought our people together, and using some of the technology we have, like GIS and other mapping resources, they provide the survey. We make sure it gets distributed, and so that the most amount of individuals, property owner, business owners, can go ahead and complete that survey so that the model is more accurate. And then when that's done, they have a deliverable, and that deliverable is a report, and it will measure, as I said, both the short-term and the long-term impacts, and there's a timetable for this project. It's underway, as you know, and we expect the final report in the middle of November.
Great. How do we refer to, who are we referring to as the vendor on this?
It's Dr. Joey Von Nessen.
Von Nessen.
Dr. Von Nessen.
Will Dr. Von Nessen have access to our hydrology study that sort of shows the timetable, or is that necessary, or does he just know that we're looking at, you know, 2 years, 4 years, whatever?
Excellent question, Mayor. You're correct. He's been put in contact with ATM.
Good.
Who was the firm, as you know, that has helped model the impacts of the sediment once it's dropped.
Okay.
So yes, he is in communication.
Great. Any other, and I'm assuming this will, what he'll be surveying is kayak businesses, shrimping, hospitality, boat rentals, the whole gamut that is Shem Creek.
That's right.
Great. Yeah. Any questions? All right, well, thank you very much. We will move on to item E, review of town and federal employment and tax guidelines regarding 1099 outside contractors for town services, and review of town regulations regarding security access and use of town facilities. We are in discussion of certain contracts and things, the details of which we cannot divulge. But the question has arisen, what is a 1099 employee,
And given that this is government property in a public building and we're behind secure doors and those type things, how does that play out? And in what realms in the town do we have 1099 employees? And what you know, is there a handbook, a point? Well, they're not employees, but what guidelines are in effect for those?
Yeah, well, thank you, Mayor. As you would suspect, the town's a fairly good-sized operation. We employ what's categorized as 1099 employees quite often. But when and how to characterize an employee has been defined by, we look to the United States Department of Labor for that information. And this is their quote, that the U.S. Supreme Court has on a number of occasions indicated that there's no single rule or test for determining whether an individual is an independent contractor or an employee, that it really boils down to the situation that controls. So then it becomes, okay, so then how do you determine if someone is an independent contractor or an employee? And they have categories or factors of which to look at and study the relationship of their work. Two of the factors that are most applicable for discussions that are being had. First is behavioral control, and that's whether there's a right to direct or control how the worker does his or her work, and that's very important. Very important. So a 1099, myself or someone else involved at the town or town council, certainly through its function, can go ahead and direct the work, meaning you will go ahead and perform this activity or task or action. But what the difference is whether the employer, in our case the town, says where, when, or how you do that work. That's the key, where, when, or how. And whether it's an attorney or it's someone, an air conditioning repairman, we may say this needs to be done, but we don't direct when, how, or where they complete that work. Another important factor is the relationship of the parties, how the business and worker perceive the relationship. And normally that boils down to the permanency of the relationship. If it's a permanent, means you hire an employee and unless something happens, there's a good chance that employee could be around a little while. And that is a more of a permanency type situation. Any contractor, there's really no permanency there. And that could be a contractor, if we're using the same example of an air conditioning repair person, that's by contract. They're there to do a job. If it doesn't happen, you go on to somebody else. In fact, our attorney situation over the years has been a contract too. So the permanency test, at least in my opinion, doesn't apply there. So that's how... those are the steps that we go through and we review when determining whether someone is a 1099, an independent contractor, or not. Actually, there's a independent contractor definition that is provided to us by the IRS, and a lot of these trades or occupations won't surprise you for what is an independent contractor, but they list in here doctors, dentists, veterinarians, lawyers, accountants, contractors, subcontractors, stenographers, or auctioneers. Those are some of the professions that they list. So that's how we go about, Mayor, determining the relationship. One last thing is the federal government's laws are to protect that person, to protect that employee. That's what they're designed for. So really, if that person's walking into a situation with eyes wide open as to what the relationship is, that's very important. That's something we look for. We don't have any positions here, at least none that I'm aware of, where that person should be treated as an employee, and we're purposefully trying to make them an independent contractor so as to avoid the payment of benefits and other things.
So here's a question I would have. If you provide an office space, mm-hmm. and give someone a security badge, you are giving the impression that that person is an employee of the town. I mean, the air conditioned guys don't get, or ladies, don't get security badges. I assume they work on the premises supervised or no?
Yes, that's correct.
Supervised. So we don't say, here's a security badge, come in and out as you want?
That's correct.
Okay. Also, I mean, I have a family member who was told you're a 1099 employee, and when they went to file their taxes, they were told, did they tell you where to work, when to work, and give you a business card with their business on it? And the answer was yes, and they said, you're not a 1099 employee. This is a CPA. I'm not a CPA. So especially when it comes to legal, we have offices in here. They have security badges. They send out things on our stationery, and I'm just wondering, how is that a 1099 employee?
Yeah. Well, sir, I laid out the details as I see them already.
Okay.
I would say it would be very difficult for anyone to provide the legal services that are expected to operate this town without having access to the departments of the town. I'd say 85% of that person's job is the intermingling and coordination with staff. And it'll be difficult to have a roving person and not have a place they can sit, interview people in private, perform emails and other tasks.
Do we want to comply with the IRS? I mean, we want to make sure that any 1099 we do passes muster, right?
Of course, sir.
So would there be any objection to us getting an opinion on that from the IRS or from the state, from the Department of Labor? I mean, it's an interesting, if I get a letter from somebody and it has the town's thing on it, and in any department, it can be recreation, it can be public services, and they are in fact not an employee of the town, that's a really, that to me, that seems like a very gray area.
Yeah. Well, sir, it's certainly up to you and members of committee to help us with that, because there are some good points that you raise. We reached out to the neighboring communities who have a similar relationship with their attorney.
Right.
And we haven't been able to get from them any causes for concern.
Okay, but still, their compliance or lack of compliance is not necessarily the standard that we would apply. So does the committee have any concerns over this? If not, we'll move on.
I mean, I do a good bit of work in the human resources field, and I don't see any concerns with
okay.
Legally speaking, I don't. I mean, we could get an opinion, but I don't think there would be any concerns there. So I wouldn't be in favor of spending the money to get an opinion.
Yeah, that's not what I was implying.
Oh, I thought you meant
no,
the buyer's
no,
credit.
Just
take a look at it. Oh, okay.
You could ask the Department of Labor or whatever.
Okay.
Do we have other 1099s? Like, how about people in recreation that are coaching or leading classes or something like? Are they 1099 employees?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And they do use our facilities. You know, it just occurred to me, and with Attorney Miller being here, this is his line of expertise. If you were so willing and the committee wished it, he, not to put you on the spot, Bruce, but, I mean, he may be willing to weigh in on it if you found that helpful.
If the committee doesn't want to delve into this, I'm fine moving on. I mean, I have a lot of questions, and not to focus just on the lawyers, but when we've got folks that are representing themselves officially as town employees, there's an implied responsibility, and I'm assuming consummate liability that goes with that. And I was thinking this is a good time to find out what are our regulations? What do we expect of that person? How do we present that person to the public? Are they a town employee or are they a 1099 independent contractor? I would love to hear what Bruce has to say, but it's the will of the committee.
That's fine. Yeah.
Y'all okay doing that? Okay.
Yeah.
Bruce, would you come up, and this is Attorney Bruce Miller. Thank you.
So first of all, let me, a couple of points to make sure everyone's straight. You either have a W-2 employee or a 1099 contractor, right? They don't blend. So it's when I hear this, the terminology used a lot in my practice, someone will say a 1099 employee. That's really a, Unfortunately, Mr. Mayor, that's an oxymoron. You can't have that, all right? So as some of the things Mr. DeMora were saying were very much correct, but it really boils down to state law as to whether a person is deemed to be an independent contractor or an employee. The security issues, I know in the federal government that right up here at SPAWAR, or what used to be called SPAWAR, the federal government employed many, many independent contractors to do the work for the federal government. They had full access to the SPAWAR facilities, even though they were independent contractors. So that's an example of the security item. But as Mr. DeMora said, the ultimate factor is whether the control. So a lot of times, say, hospitals will hire physicians to be independent contractors to work in their emergency room. And they're not employees because the hospital is not going to tell the physician how to practice medicine. It's a control item. If that gives the committee some education, I'd be happy to answer any individual particular questions.
I was talking with a businessman this weekend, and after the death of Truett Cathy with Chick-fil-A, they changed law firms. And they were advised that their leadership training or how to manage their franchises and took people, made them W-2 employees because they were telling them where to do it, when to do it, how to do it. And so Chick-fil-A no longer does the training, which they're famous for. And this person helped write their guidelines, helped write their training. And so this is a question that I know that's probably a federal issue. You said state is the important thing here, but especially when we've advertised for a position to be an employee. And then if we turn and say, okay, you can have the position, but you're not going to be an employee, I think we're muddying the waters a little bit.
Well, it's true that the town has advertised in the past for a general counsel position to be an employee, but as long as the parties go into the relationship knowing, and as in the proposed agreement, that the control items are taken away, and that you could have a position similar to, there are physicians that work for hospitals that do become employees, and so you can put it either way you want to. You can draw up a document. I could draw up an agreement. Someone could be an employee and be a general counsel, or someone could be an outside individual independent contractor, basically doing the same job.
Right. Okay. Any council? Any questions? Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate it. Eric, thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Item F is discussion and possible action with regard to emergency ordinance mandating wearing a mask, to include the possibility of making it applicable to all retail stores. Excuse me. With children under age 12 at the discretion of parents, guardians, and the last part was just put in there because some of the objections we got at the last emergency meeting when we passed it by a supermajority was that it was not enforceable, and I found out that Aiken made theirs a trespass ordinance, and thank you, Mr. Pagliarini, for the background on that. So this will be on our agenda for tomorrow. I thought it would be good for the committee to go over some of the details.
Thank you,
Mayor. I'll give it to you.
Yes, sir. What we have on the screen and what was sent to you isn't essentially an updated version of what we had prior, and it incorporates what is on the agenda today. And of course, that includes retail as part of the coverage and the enforcement mechanism, as the mayor said, which we'll get to in a little more detail. And it does exempt those 12 and under as requested. So when you look at it, you'll find all similarities with those exceptions, which are fairly significant exceptions. You all are aware And the public is aware that the governor issued an order about a month ago, and the governor's order covers several things. And for just for a refresher, the first is that the governor urged the South Carolina municipalities to act, enact face mask ordinances. The governor requires face coverings in state government offices and buildings, requires face coverings in restaurants. And if you've read the governor's order, which I have available if you'd like to go through that, there is a fairly substantial list of requirements for restaurants, including alcohol sales and the like.
And can I just, before we go too far,
yep.
The governor did urge us to pass ordinances, not resolutions, encouraging people to do it. He asked us to pass ordinances, right? Legal ordinances.
That's correct, sir.
Okay, thank you.
And then finally, there is a requirement in that face coverings at gatherings, as defined in the order. Gatherings does not appear to cover retail. It appears to be gatherings, as esoteric as that may be. And of course, the state does have a much more powerful and significant mechanism to enforce. State law allows for that. And of course, our law enforcement officers are authorized by the state to enforce the state provision, this order, as provided in state law. Mayor, you suggested one of the municipalities, Aiken, and this is what some have done. Of course, we had this discussion 2 months ago. How do you enforce it? One of the ways to do it is by trespass, and it is a mechanism for our enforcement. I don't have really any comments on the effectiveness of enforcement and whether that is a matter for this committee and the council, also with assistance from our police chief. But that is the way we would do it if we were to make it a misdemeanor as opposed to the current civil fine.
Okay. Council, I'll start with Mr. Rambo, I guess. You and I kind of discussed this. I think this incorporates some of the things that you had been mentioning. Just like to get your feelings on some aspects of it. Not that.
Yeah, so I'm a big proponent in adding the exemption for children. The World Health Organization came out and updated their guidelines recently to essentially say that kids 6 and under should not be wearing masks at all, and that kids through age 11 or 12, basically there was a list of guidelines that should be met in order to force the child to wear a mask, essentially, and it talked about their psychological health and all of that. And so essentially, I just think it's a parent's right to make that decision for their child. And so by making them totally exempt doesn't mean kids can't wear them. They certainly can if their parents want them to. Another comment I had was since the state, since the governor's order includes restaurants, shouldn't we include restaurants in ours just to make them match?
Good question.
It just seems.
I don't know if it's redundant or if it would be consistent.
Well, it isn't. And Mayor, you may recollect back in the early phases, a lot of the time what we did was incorporate those
yes.
orders into our ordinance.
Yes.
I'll tell you, Mr. Rambo, my concern for doing it verbatim is if those orders change week to week, month. I mean, this one's been in effect for quite a while, 4 weeks. But as we know, in the world of orders issued by the governor, those things can change quickly. Certainly, we have the ability to have our own restaurant ordinance if that's what the council wishes. But if it is simply to match that language, I would simply incorporate whatever order the governor has at that point.
Okay. And then I do have questions about the misdemeanor thing. I guess I don't really understand it, how that works. How is it trespassing? I'm unclear.
It's a good question, but essentially by having someone on the property not in compliance with town ordinance, they're essentially not allowed to be on that property, and it crosses the line. If you read that trespass, there's basically a provision in state code that says, well, if you're on there for any reason that you're not supposed to be on there for, that's considered a trespass. But yes, sir, it is.
Wouldn't it already be trespassing, though? Like if I'm a grocery store owner and somebody's on my property and we've told them they have to have a face mask sign on or they have to have a face mask on or they need to leave, and they don't leave, is that not already trespassing?
I think the individual business owners, if they have a policy and remove someone from the property and that person doesn't, it will not leave, then yes, sir, it can become that. I would say that if we're going to enact an ordinance, we have to prescribe a penalty for that as well. So I hear and I understand what you're saying, but for total clarification, if council wanted to make this a misdemeanor, I believe it more appropriate to have it in the ordinance.
Yes, ma'am.
So I am definitely in favor of extending the emergency ordinance. There was an article, I'm pulling it up, in Forbes magazine that said that coronavirus cases dropped 46% in parts of South Carolina with mask mandates compared to areas without. So I think that that's really helpful to the health of our community. I am comfortable with making it applicable to all retail stores. In fact, I tried to amend our first mask ordinance to have that when we first passed that, and that failed. I'm comfortable with making under the age of 12 discretion. I don't think I'm comfortable making it a trespass because currently it's a civil fine and there's opportunity for businesses to enforce it with themselves. And I think that adding the police component, the policing component into it, I think that there's better use of our officers' time. And I think that leaving it to the businesses and leaving it to our code enforcement. And also, I mean, it's just like traffic laws, right? Like any sort of law you have, people comply with it because they want to comply with it. And there's no way to enforce at every moment, at every time, people following, you know, traffic laws. And it's the same thing with this mask ordinance. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. And I think that people do respect the law, and I think that they will follow it. But I think that making it a harsher penalty, making it a misdemeanor, I think is going a little bit too far.
Yeah, and there was no advocacy. I reached out to some other municipalities. Remember when we passed ours, there were maybe half a dozen, Greenville, Columbia, Charleston, and maybe some others. And since then, there are 80 that are passed. And North Charleston and Goose Creek, who initially declined to do them, ended up, their mayors ended up doing them by proclamation. It became that serious and that important to do it. And then, as you said, the numbers have dropped. But if there was any objection or any alternatives to be looked at for enforcement, since that issue was raised, that's just one idea. I certainly am not saying that I advocate it, but it's out there.
So I would echo those thoughts. And with the current unfortunate national state that we're in with, people's unfortunate mistrust of our police officers and things, I don't think putting them in any situations where they're enforcing face mask ordinances would be, you know, a good recipe there. So anyway, so... I guess I would just like to move to replace section 3 with the language from the old ordinance about I think it was like a $25 civil fine or something like that.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And Mr. Pagliarini, could we do this as a committee just to recommend to the council tomorrow that we look this over? We got advice, and it's just a recommendation from Police, Judicial, and Legal.
Yes, sir. As usual, it would be very helpful if this committee would pinpoint some of those questions, at least so we have it in the proposed ordinance. And then,
right,
as you well know, council could make amendments as
absolutely
they see fit.
And keeping in mind, this is an emergency ordinance, so it would take a 2/3 majority, and it would only be effective for 61 days unless rescinded prior to that.
That's correct.
So is that going to be a form of a motion?
Yes, that was a motion.
Second?
It's second.
A second? Discussion?
And I would like to actually amend, like, see if Mr. Randall would amend that motion to include the part about the underage 12 and the, you know, the emergency ordinance for all retail, or is that what?
Oh, yes, correct. I was just looking at section 3
section 3
with the penalty.
Okay.
So I wasn't touching section 2, so just
right.
section
3. So we're just, so it would be this document, just
mm-hmm.
changing
right.
section 3.
That's correct. My understanding.
Okay.
Yes,
right.
Yes, ma'am.
And,
ma'am,
and that includes those two provisions.
I just wasn't sure exactly what the language was from last time, so I couldn't recite it. But
from a procedural standpoint, we're not extending the old ordinance. This is a new ordinance, stands on its own, so that's not necessary.
Okay.
But understanding, we'll leave that language in as it relates to
all retail,
those two issues.
Okay.
All right. Any other discussion? All in favor of the motion to amend the draft, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Any other additions or corrections to the draft emergency ordinance?
Yeah, I would like to make a motion to include restaurants under whatever.
Matt, before we get a second, would it be helpful if we said, rather than picking one or two, that from a legal standpoint, that ours mirror the executive orders from the governor, whether it's restaurant or bars or whatever, gatherings, all of that, so it's not just one?
We can do it three ways, I think. We can create our own restaurant language. We can simply adopt and include the language in the governor's order. Or third, we can simply reference the governor's order as to what is appropriate at the time. For example, if the governor were to alter that order on Tuesday night, then
that would save us having to have a meeting.
Match up. So I think those are the three ways.
How about that? That way ours doesn't come obsolete if they change it in 24 hours.
Well, I mean, my opinion would be if 2 weeks from now he all of a sudden says, you know, he's not mandating them in restaurants anymore, that doesn't mean that we don't.
Okay.
That's the downside of doing it that way. Yes, sir. That's correct.
Restaurants have been hit really hard. So
anyway, just go ahead with your motion.
So that was my motion, was just to include restaurants. And I don't know if legally bars are different, but I guess you could say bars and restaurants.
Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
The only discussion I would have is to make sure that we are covering exactly what we mean to be covering: bars, restaurants, food.
Yes. Oh, and I should say with that, we would also have to add an exemption that it, you know, while you're eating and drinking, you don't have to have it on. That's probably pretty obvious, but.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's not a mask, it's a napkin.
Yeah. Gross.
All right. So we have a motion, we have a second. Any further discussion? All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, the motion carries. Is there any other discussion on masks? All right, thank you very much. That concludes item F. Item G is discussion and possible action with regard to fines for violation of ordinances governing signs. Somebody pick this up and fill me in here.
I believe this was requested by Councilmember Santos. Do you?
Not sure what the rules are. I know town got in trouble for this once before about council members not on committees, so I don't want to create a.
Yes, sir. As long as the council member is not taking place in the discussion
over here.
Votes, if you'd like to hear from a council member.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor and the committee.
Morning.
I put this on here, as you see from the picture above. There are a tremendous amount of signs that are being put around Mount Pleasant. And as you know, we have a law against putting signs in rights of ways, but there's no teeth in the law. And so this is the Children's Memorial here, and these signs are taken from the Children's Memorial as well as the Veterans Memorial. People are putting signs up everywhere, all over the place, and then they fall down and nobody picks them up. Now, our code enforcement officer, who's extremely busy doing all kinds of other things, has to go around and pick these signs up off the street. Now, I'm not talking about sandwich boards like you see on Coleman Boulevard, the ones they stick out during the day and they take in during the night. I'm talking about these type signs here. If you look at them, some of them don't even tell you whether they're in Mount Pleasant or not. They could be in Charleston. It just gives you a website to go to. So I think we need some teeth in our ordinance, because although it's against the law to put signs in rights of ways, there's no teeth into it to penalize anybody from doing that. So they, you know, our code enforcement officer is responsible for picking all these signs up. And I know you all see the signs just like I do. And going over the connector the other day, the ones that have blown down have been down for weeks. And you can't see them unless you're close to them, but they end up making their way into our waterways and into the environment. And so I just wanted to make sure that we are able to put some teeth in this ordinance. And if our ordinance says signs can't be in the rights of ways, we need to be able to enforce it somehow. And I think that should be probably a penalty, because our code enforcement officer needs to be doing a lot of other things rather than picking up people's signs that they put on the ground and don't pick up. As I said, I'm not talking about the sandwich boards like you see in front of the businesses that they take in. These are the signs, type of signs here that I'm talking about that are put up all over the place, on our highways, on our roadways, and on our memorials. But there's no enforcement. There's nothing we can do to enforce them from stop doing them. You pick them up, they put them back. And so right now on the way here, I saw there was two on our Veterans Memorial again. And so we need to be able to put some teeth in the ordinance. And I'm not sure how much y'all want to charge for it, but it is against the law now. It's just that we can't enforce it.
Thank you.
When it comes to public signs, if you want to, we can give them 30 days before their election to put up the public signs, but they have to be gone the next day or whatever. So we can have signs, because a lot of times, as you see, there's signs that last for a long time after elections that are up that our code enforcement officer hasn't picked up, hadn't had time to pick up because he's so busy doing something else, so the signs stayed. So I think also we ought to make it, you know, to where we at least give X amount of days, and then after that, there should be a penalty.
Committee?
What is, Mr. DeMora, what is the current, it's not a penalty, it's just removal of the sign? There's no fine or anything associated with having a sign in the right-of-way?
Yeah, I think we've got someone.
Jeff?
Yeah. He'll give you the full background.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. If you recall, you have an ordinance amendment moving to final reading next week with council. That would deal with making it very clear that we have the authority to physically remove illegal temporary signs from rights of way. So we'll be able to cover that removal. It does require us as a staff to be the ones, the dog chasing its tail throughout town, constantly picking and removing and then collecting, and sometimes people even then want to have their sign back, and we know exactly what's going to happen next. They'll put it back out in generally the same location. It is also a violation of the zoning ordinance, of the sign ordinance, and we have the mechanisms to enforce this, any zoning violation, but that takes, I mean, by the time we would go through the due process of notifications and citations and having to figure out how you even deliver the citation to somebody who's responsible for that sign. I mean, the sign could be gone. So I, in terms of issuing citations and fines for that kind of signage, I think most communities end up resorting to what it is that we do. We just remove the darn things ourselves. And, we could elevate the requirement and be able to cite and issue citations, tickets, for folks who do this in addition to just physically removing them. But it's just the nature of these kind of temporary snipe signs that get put up, you know, all over the place. And then on private property themselves, then we don't go on private property to remove such signs. That's where we would be able to contact a property owner and then issue a citation that you have 27 of these and you exceed the ordinance number. And that's where we would be able to use the citation component, the enforcement piece that we already have.
So obviously the right-of-way is already covered.
It's,
you can't have it in there under any circumstances, and we remove it.
In the ordinance,
right.
It is not clear about the removal aspect, and that's why we're making it perfectly clear in the ordinance amendment moving to completion next week that the zoning administrator and or designee, the staff, enforcement officer, has the ability to physically pick those signs up and remove them, and then we have no doubts.
Right.
About that part of it. It's just a matter of the resource demand of staff having to do that work for people.
So we've got that ordinance working its way that comes to us, what, at our next council meeting?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So that's about the rights of way.
Correct.
What about the private property aspect? Is your concern about both?
The rights of way.
Well, he's already said that they can penalize them on private property.
On private property.
We just can't penalize them on the rights of ways.
Right.
And I'm just wanting to add that to the rights of ways. So we've already got it on the personal property. I want to add it to the rights of ways.
Would it legally, would we be able with, because what you're talking about is a, What type of ordinance is it? Not a zoning, but a zoning.
Yeah.
All right. So does zoning apply to rights-of-ways technically?
In this circumstance, it does, sir. And I think just a procedural, one of the issues is we have an ordinance coming up for final reading. I'd have to talk it over with Jeff. I think some of the concern that I would have is whether we'd notice that and whether we'd have to go back through the Planning Commission process to do that.
Okay.
But that's just a consideration that we'll have to work out if that's what council wants to consider.
So Gary, that would address, that's where we would address what you're talking about, is having a penalty for putting it in a right-of-way.
In a right-of-way.
Yeah.
Just like I said, just like we do on private property.
Yeah. Quick question, this being an election year, fortunately not a municipal election, but I know political signs have a different leeway, but if you wanted to get somebody else in trouble, you'd get their signs and put them in the right-of-way, all right? So if someone gets a citation for that, can they come and say, I did not authorize having my signs put in the right-of-way?
Sir, they could be treated like any charge, ticket,
okay,
or offense in court.
Right, and they have to plead their case.
Yes, sir.
Got it. In municipal court.
And they're technically, you give them leeway, 30 days, give them some time.
Okay.
People who put out the signs know where they put them pretty much. And,
right.
And they're putting them in high traffic areas, not in areas where people aren't going to see them. So, you know, maybe give them 30 days after the election. I mean, I'm open to that when those type of signs, because I agree with you, we don't want to see any abuse.
Right.
But seriously, after a year, and I still see unelected official signs still out there right now.
Right.
Who didn't get on. But the point is, they need to be able to pick them up. And if you've got a team, your team needs to be able to help you pick them up after. So we could give them 30 days after the election or a little bit of leeway there. But I'm talking about signs like these. That are up there and that you don't even know whether or not they're in Mount Pleasant or not.
Right.
They could be advertising for another municipality. You just don't know.
Okay.
So.
Sure. One thing that's really tough in having done political signs is that there's no line that shows you where the right-of-way ends and where the private property begins. So sometimes you have permission on private property and you think you put it on private property, but it's actually
in the right of way,
and it's just tough.
I think it's historically, if it's anything in front of the telephone poles, is a right of way. Is that correct? That's what I've been told.
You try to use a physical feature like that, sidewalks, if there are sidewalks, if it's behind the sidewalk, behind the curb, you just have to apply judgment. Clearly, if it's 6 inches off the curb or the pavement or whatever, you know it's pretty much in the right of way. And we do allow campaigns or in for election signs. We typically try to say, you know, elections on a Tuesday, give them like 2 weekends to pick up. Mm-hmm. And then at that point, they're probably not going to get picked up. And staff is in the unfortunate position of having to be the cleanup crew for some of those things.
I would say I think it's worse right now than ever, mainly because we were, you know, trying to be supportive of businesses, and we temporarily suspended the entire temporary sign ordinance, which we should have. But I think that all of a sudden all these businesses started ordering a bunch of signs, and instead of just putting signs outside their own business, they started just throwing them everywhere. And so hopefully if we could just get them removed quickly and toss them, maybe they'll stop. I don't know. But
our game plan is September the 9th, the day after your election, I mean, your action on that ordinance amendment, then we would begin a full-fledged sweep of the town and take care of those kinds of things.
Okay.
And we would also work from with Lauren in terms of the business community, letting them know, you know, the rules have changed. It's no longer emergency ordinance that suspended enforcement of those temporary signs. The town will be removing those.
And we're not talking about all signs. Like I said, sandwich boards.
Right.
Like on Coleman, you know, they take them in at night and then they put them back out in the day. I don't have an issue with that because they are taking them in. And it's these ones that they put out and they don't come pick up in the rights of ways. They're there forever. And that, like I say, I see them there all the time when I ride my bike. Nobody picks them up. And so it ends up going into the marsh or you know, into the environment. And so I think it needs to be teeth. And if we're doing it for the private citizens, if they're able to be penalized, then certainly anybody who puts it in the public rights away should be able to be penalized as well.
Let me ask a procedural question. Mr. Paglini, do we need action by this committee to, I mean, that's second reading, that has to be an amendment by a member of council at that. I don't know that coming from committee before that reading is going to be effective, is it, or is it?
No, sir, there is no recommendation required here.
Right.
As I said, I think we have to have the discussion as to whether an amendment of this nature would alter, again, public hearings and what we've advertised.
Okay.
I think that's a legitimate discussion we have to have. And of course, if it's determined that that's necessary, we have to go through the process, planning commission and the like. So one way or another, I just don't think action today is necessary.
Okay. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I think that with the businesses, it's easy to tell who's putting out these signs and you know that they're doing it. But with political signs, like you said, I mean, it's possible for people to say, oh, I want 10 of your signs. And then they, you know, there's a potential for abuse there and creating additional problems for a political candidate who then has to go to municipal court and defend themselves. And I think that this is something maybe that needs to be looked at very carefully, perhaps by the Planning Commission, and have them take a look at the sign ordinance and see where, you know, where we can make parallels between what's with private property versus public property and what exceptions and carve outs can be done for political signage where there's a leeway granted there. Because I mean, it's already hard enough to be a political candidate and to run for office, and to create additional barriers to that or additional problems for people who are running for office, I think is not a positive thing. But I mean, do we allow political signs? I mean, I think people did, but I never put any signs in the right of way myself because I thought that wasn't allowed.
No, that's a temporary sign that is not allowed in the right of way either.
Okay, so political signs are never allowed in a right of way. Okay.
Right.
People do it. Oh my goodness.
Do it. They come get your signs and then they put them up.
And then they put them up. And we have no control over that.
Right.
Yeah.
One thing we could look at and we've talked about is rather than relying on the term right of way, which you don't know where it is, there could be ways to put measurable sort of distances. Take three giant steps from whatever it is, the curb, the sidewalk, the edge of pavement, and then even if you're still in the right of way, but far enough away. So there may be a way we could put a physical measure in there rather than this imaginary line that nobody knows where it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that might help us in terms of everybody understanding and you wouldn't have to use telephone poles or other features. You just say, pace it off and
6 feet or something.
You know what it is. So we could look at something like that and follow up on that.
Yeah, I agree with that because the right-of-way line varies based on the street. I mean, like my neighborhood, it's 35 feet from the center of the road, so it's nearly halfway into my front yard, technically. And their properties, I've looked for friends over, like Sullivan's Island, the right-of-way is, you know, half that much, 18 feet or whatever. So
sometimes the right-of-way of a road actually changes on the road itself.
Mm. Yeah, so it would make sense to designate a specific distance. And
okay.
I do think it's hard to know who to fine in almost any of these situations, like one of your employees, but I guess you're responsible if they grab one out of the back room and think of a good place, but the business owner would be the one fined. I don't know how to hold who responsible with that, but
That's an enforcement. We make the law. Other people enforce it, right?
I think the owners
we can deputize
and the employees and all that, we'll let them know if they see signs. And I don't think, you know, political signs, I'm going on my 20th year of doing this. I've never had any issues with my signs. If somebody does put them in the right of way, they're picked up and they brought down to town hall, you have to come get them. It's really not a big deal. But
if it becomes a big deal, right? That's if we change the rule, then it becomes a big deal
to
the candidate.
Well, that's only like 30 days after the election. Then yeah, you should pick up your signs. You know, if you've got a team of people putting out your signs, you have to remind them that they got to pick them up after it. You know, I mean, if not, it's going to end up in the environment. I mean, I think the environmentalists will love to hear this, that we're actually trying to protect the environment from these plastic signs that you see are just left in the roadway. I mean, on the side and end up in our woods and end up in our marshes. So I think there's got to be a way that we have some teeth in the ordinance so people be more responsible with their signs.
Right, I think we know. Thank you for the advice, Gary. Thanks for bringing this to our attention, and we'll look at it at the second reading.
Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes item G. Item H is discussion of possible action on short-term rentals and enforcement measures to include an update on the short-term rental program and penalties for violations. I don't know about y'all, but I get a good many constituent concerns about short-term rentals, especially in their neighborhoods. We have someone here today who there was a drug overdose in an Airbnb across the street from their house, and police and fire and ambulance and all of that in a Mount Pleasant neighborhood, and nobody, not, the biggest advocates of short-term rentals don't want that. And so what we found out was in some cases, you have one that's operating illegally, they get a citation, they've been doing it, you know, until they get caught, and then they apply for it, and they get their license, and then they just keep on doing the same thing. So we got in on, I would call it the ground floor of Airbnb ordinances and regulations, and we know that it will take time to get it right. But I'll just tell you personally, one of the concerns I have is, instead of being a responsible, like some of our good friends here today and those who advocate, you know, proper ordinances and compliance thereto, if you're just a scofflaw and then you get caught, and then there's basically no downside. It's bad for the community. It's bad for the reputable short-term rentals, not to pick on one particular method of that. So let's get a quick overview. I know we're running late. If we could get the short version of this, and then I don't know that we will be drafting anything new today, but I think the best outcome of this committee meeting might be to come back in a month with some improved and stiffer penalties for those who don't play by the rules. Mr. Ulmer?
Thank you, Mayor. Just in the scheme of things, wanted to share with committee, and we'll do the same thing with planning committee this afternoon, kind of the steps we've gone through to this point, where we spent a long time working on the ordinance, and then our next phase was moving into administering a brand new program, and then we've been mostly in this initial period of getting the system up and running. The ordinance was adopted last August, made effective January 1. You remember some of the key features of it. The program we established last fall, and we publicized it, and then people were up on New Year's Eve waiting to submit for January 1, 2020, their application forms. And we have a variety of requirements for submittals and the annual permit and all the information that folks have to provide to us. We have an online system where folks can register and ultimately in the future renew their permits. And then there are features in the ordinance that require an owner to provide us additional information, various affidavits and insurance and taxes, proof of sales tax, and those kinds of things. As of last week, earlier in the week, the staff team has processed 325 total applications, and there are 276 STR permits that have been issued.
And that's of our limit of 400, is that correct?
Yes, it's approximately just a little over 400. And some of them are pending, and a few just did not complete the process, or they were denied. There may be information that says they did have an HOA that precludes a short-term rental, and we don't issue a permit if it's not allowed. Just to give you a feel for where these are, this is a townwide shot of the address locations, coming in a little bit closer, and then looking in at the older part, the old village area. And it reflects what council talked about in terms of the likely locations that short-term rentals would be found. and we're already operating. So our first step in enforcement is getting folks to actually get the permit. And we identified a business license had a parallel system, and folks that were already registering and getting their business licenses, we were able to use that information and start tracking that down because they needed a separate short-term rental permit from planning. So the business license folks held off on that, and then we developed a system where those business licenses could not be renewed until they got the appropriate permit from planning. We do have software that allows us to monitor the activity, and where we've been moving now is that we're able to identify activity in the short-term rental business areas and sort of create categories of if a property was advertised and or actively being rented in these sort of time intervals. And we have moved into the first notice letters for those folks who had been operating without a permit from planning over the past, say, the past month. And that's where we are now, working on those. And we sent out first contact letters to 184 folks. Then we had second contact, as we've been following out, another 67, and third contact even, as we've been trying to get people to comply with the permitting requirements. And of the 184 that we sent out the first time around, 135 owners responded, but 49 didn't. And that's where you see us having to continue to do second and third notices. And we still have about 100 that we're working on that require notification to bring them in, either in compliance or identifying the fact that maybe they no longer rent the property out. So we purposefully started this, wanting, of course, with a new program to get people to comply with the ordinance. That's the objective. We did get a few complaints about some renter issues as we were in this early phase. We did issue one citation for not having a permit because we had a number of complaints on that particular property. They were in the midst of applying and received their permit, and actually that permit was issued and the case was dismissed in court. And so now where we're moving, I think, is into the activity. Now you have permitted locations, and if there are issues and problems, we start to move into the next phase.
Can I ask, what in that case, somebody gets busted for operating a short-term rental without a permit, is there a penalty? Is there a fine? Is there a waiting period?
We issue it. In that one, we issued a ticket for not having the permit, and there is a fine. I can't remember if we said at $475, and I mean it went to court, and so that owner had to come in and explain the situation. But again, they were in the midst of getting their permit, and the judge saw, well, you've now received your permit, behave. And so now we're in the operation side of the enforcement piece.
How much did you say that fine was?
I think it's $475. Is that what we issued? Can't be more than $500 by state law.
Okay.
The other thing, we had a lot of questions about, well, why don't you just issue tickets for people who don't have a permit while you're in this early phase? Technically, nobody. We would have had to issue a citation to everybody on day two that did not have a permit because we hadn't processed them yet. And again, that wasn't our objective. We want to get people in line. And there are now enforcement provisions that we can follow for certain things like noise and trash or exceeding the occupancy that's allowed under the permit. We can go ahead and issue a violation or a ticket, but it's as written in the ordinance and as requested by the operators, it takes a while to get there. It's sort of four strikes and you're out. Where we can do a first warning, a second warning, then a third violation becomes a penalty with the ticket. And fourth violation, then we would move to revoking that business license or notice that that business license would not be renewed. But this has to occur within single rental periods. So you don't get four complaints in a, say, a one-week period. You might get four complaints in a week on one property, but that would only count as one. And then if they got another set of renters in there and they had complaints again, so it's a cumulative and a time process to be able to reach the point of you know, us really being able to truly enforce the ordinance. But that was what requested, that was what was modeled on or in the model ordinances that we used and looked at as the ordinance was developed. And then there also is a revocation piece.
Ms. Will?
Mr. Olmos, going back to that one slide. So conceivably, I could continually have a warning, but as long as the tenants changed, I could get a warning every 3 days. And as long as the tenants changed, I would only get a warning. There would be no rise to a penalty. So you could be a serial offender by allowing people to rent your short-term rental that are violating things. But as long as there's only one, two violations per 2 to 3 day period, then there truly is no penalty and no revocation of the license.
No, it would be cumulative in terms of if it was one renter and a set of issues, we would issue the warning. Another group came in, a third group, and then ultimately at the fourth level. So it's over the roll, it's over a year period.
Oh, this, I thought this was a single rental contract period.
The citations or the offenses are counted during a single rental contract period. In effect, you can't have a neighbor call 17 times in a 3 day weekend and have 17 violations. That would be counted as one, even though there might have been issues multiple times during that rental period.
How do we know what the rental period is?
We know what it is.
We do?
Yes, through the software system.
Hmm.
So if someone, so there's a raucous party for a 3 day weekend and I call every single day that they're in there and the police have to come out every single day that they're in there, that still only counts as one violation?
As written under the ordinance.
Oh.
Now we can do other things in terms of nuisances or, you know, elevate it, but as set out and as what was requested when the ordinance was being prepared, this is how it was set up.
Mr. Mayor, the planning committee is also taking a look at this later on today, so I know we're very far behind on time, and I don't know if you are comfortable with planning taking this up further, but this seems to me to be incredibly favorable to the STRs and not favorable to the communities that live around these STRs and have to live with these situations. And so I think we need to take a very close look at the penalties and the revocations. And also if someone, like I know, for example, one of the constituents that reached out to me, this person was a serial offender without their STR permit and then was granted one anyway, because there's nothing in the granting process that prevents someone from getting an STR if they're a serial offender.
Right.
So I think that we need to take a look at that too on the back end, where if you've been issued multiple citations for problems at your STR, at your illegal STR, you shouldn't be allowed to get a tree
permit. Just make
permit.
It right and then call it good.
Exactly.
Look at like a waiting period. That's where I was going with this. If you operate illegally and you're discovered, you shouldn't have your permit right away. There should be a mandatory waiting period, and then we know where you are, we know you're illegal, and we need to look at that. Mr. Rambo?
Instead of waiting for people to complain about a certain short-term rental, are we not like looking through Airbnb or VRBO and some of these sites and just verifying that these people that are advertising their short-term rentals are actually licensed? It seems like that would be a very...
No, that's part of how we identify folks that don't have a permit yet.
Okay.
So we're on the cusp of getting the program going and getting people under the permit system. And now you're moving into the operational phase where when we have complaints, how will we deal with those particular complaints?
Okay.
And we can revoke a permit. So there's even one more level that the zoning administrator and or the planning director, we could actually revoke a permit and you can't get a business license or a permit for a year. And there's a waiting period, but we have to elevate it to that level before we can enforce it to that degree.
May I ask another quick question, because I know we were part of this, it took forever. Are you not required, if you have a short-term rental, to have on-site parking rather than them spilling out into the street? Because that's a common complaint in my neighborhood and in others where we know there's short-term rentals. You can tell they come in my neighborhood on Thursdays And the owner's cars are there, and then Thursday evening through the weekend, there's three, sometimes four cars in the street. And I just didn't think that was right. I couldn't remember chapter and verse, but I thought we said if you have a short-term rental, you have to have parking on site.
There is a parking requirement for maybe one space, one additional space per bedroom?
It's the same requirement as having a house in general. If you have a single-family residence, you're required to have one parking spot. So you're automatically, if you have a single-family residence, you've already met your requirement. So yes, it's one spot per unit.
Not an additional, not a parking lot.
That's something, I mean, this is, and when you got them on both sides of the street, you got two cars parked. You have a very narrow way to get in and out to your residential neighborhood because you've got short-term rentals that if you're, what you're saying is they only need one parking spot. And I know the ones that I see, I take pictures every weekend, there are three, sometimes four cars, and they're all in the street. So if you all would do some of the work on this too, we will move along on this. But I think it's obvious that we need to stiffen up these things. And I don't know how deep we'll go into the legalities, but these that become, and you know, there was news today in the state of South Carolina, it was a party house and they ended up with a shooting. I think somebody was killed. I know somebody was shot. But if you have one that becomes known as a party place in a residential neighborhood in Mount Pleasant, I think there ought to be some ramification for that, as opposed to just quiet enjoyment.
Mr. Mayor, I'd definitely like for this to be on the agenda next month as well, to just
yes, for this committee.
I'm going to do some homework, and then hopefully we can...
And let's see what y'all come up with, too, in planning.
Okay.
Good. So, you good? Okay, thank y'all very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That would end item H. 6H, item 7 is adjourned. Is there anything else to come before this committee? If not, we will stand adjourned. Thank y'all for hanging in.